Hello, everybody, and welcome to a very special preview version of the What a Cartoon Movie podcast for The Secret of Nim. I am one of your hosts, Rat King Bob Mackey, who is here with me today.
Fan of Sparklies, Henry Gilbert. Hi.
We all love the Sparklies. And Henry, we just talked about The Secret of Nim for about 3 hours as part of our What a Cartoon Movie podcast here on the Talking Simpsons Network on Patreon.
That's right. For the $10 and up premier folks on our Patreon, those subscribers get a monthly movie podcast, and we finished this month's movie where we did The Secret of Nim. And I gotta say, we had a ton of fun talking about this film that's actually older than me and 1 month younger than you.
It's true. It falls between the limbo of post-Bob, pre-Henry. It's a scary time to be alive. But yes, as always, we spend extra time on these movie episodes. They're even longer than our normal episodes, if you can believe that. We've managed to do it. We've harnessed the technology. We talk about the creator Don Bluth, his time at Disney, some early history of Disney in the post-war period, a troublesome period before The Little Mermaid. We talk about Don Bluth Productions, the production of Secret of Nim, and we spend about 2 hours on the entire Secret of Nim movie with clips and trivia and our dissection of the movie beat by beat.
Yeah, it was a fun time as usual, and it was great to go back through the original first Don Bluth directed film and not only just seeing, you know, what worked, what didn't work, and some of like just amazing showcases of very detailed, unique animation, but also going through how it even came to be and how, you know, Secret of Nim happens only because of the failures of the many failures of the Disney of business at the time.
That's right. And if you enjoy this snippet of our conversation about The Secret of Nim, if you go to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons and sign up at the $10 level or perhaps upgrade to the $10 level, you'll get to hear this entire podcast about The Secret of Nim along with podcasts about movies like A Goofy Movie, Akira, Kiki's Delivery Service, Batman the Animated Series. Am I missing any?
Nope, that's all.
That's all of them from now. Yes, we just started doing this in November. We'll be doing one a month until the sun burns out.
Yeah, so you've already got a dozen hours of other content you would be getting, plus all of the original videos that we did for the first 18 months of our Patreon for $10 and up subscribers. So you can get your hands on that too, just for going to 10 bucks. We really make it worth your while, and it really helps me and Bob out financially.
It really does. But yes, that's it for this little preamble to our free preview of the What a Cartoon Movie podcast for The Secret of Nim. Again, if you want to hear the whole thing, go to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons and sign up at the $10 level. If you are a new patron to our network, you'll get all kinds of bonus stuff on top of that, including limited series, end of season wrap-ups, and so much more. Too much content to list here, frankly. I'm almost out of breath. We just talked about Secret of Nim for 3 hours.
Yes, yeah. Oh my goodness. And it was a ton of fun. You're going to love it. So, and you're going to love next month's too. And you get to even vote on it if you are a subscriber at the $10 level, patreon.com/talkingsimpsons.
So please enjoy this small bit of our conversation about Don Bluth's 1982 film, The Secret of Nim. So Bluth's first projects under Don Bluth Productions were the short I mentioned before, Banjo the Woodpile Cat, and a short animated sequence for the movie Xanadu, which they completed in like a major crunch period just to sort of impress the studio and to get their name out there as people that could make amazing animation. That scene is on YouTube. It's worth watching. And at that point,
the rest of Xanadu is not worth watching.
Do not do that. Yes. At that point, I believe they're in a studio in Santa Monica. So I think it's either they finish Banjo and do Xanadu at the studio or they finish Banjo at home and then do Xanadu at the studio.
So yeah, I mean, they're not really making Nim out of the garage. They moved out of the garage by then. I did watch Banjo the Woodpile Cat. It's an interesting little film. There's some weird touches to it that make it sort of Christmassy because I found out they had thought they might sell it as a Christmas special, but then they didn't.
Yeah.
But it's still kind of set at Christmas. Scatman Crothers is the big famous guy in it, and he's fun. And it, in spirit, is very similar to... It has a lot of themes that would be in his stuff, especially... Fievel American Tale of like this giant cat helping this smaller lost little boy find his way. Like there's a lot of similarities there and some really cool little animation flourishes you're used to seeing in his stuff for sure.
It will probably give you a cavity watching it. It's so syrupy sweet.
I had to skip like 4 minutes of like, I don't want to watch the cat be sad for 4 minutes. Like let's get Scatman in here already.
But the important thing is like that short was made to resurrect these dying dying techniques at Disney and to sort of innovate new ones. And it's funny to think, and depressing kind of, it's actually more depressing to think that Bluth wanted to reinvigorate 2D animation in basically its last 20 years, that this could be possible, that this level of feature animation could be possible. Like, The Princess and the Frog is an outlier.
Oh, that, you know, yeah, that is very sad. You're right, that he wanted to do this for its, I guess, its last gasp, as it would turn out, or like the... like in the movie, in the Babe Ruth movie, where he hits his last home run and you're like, maybe everything's good for Babe Ruth now. And then it all's declined.
And
after
you make
that.
The drinky drinking motion.
And well, it's also like I'm so glad he resigned too, because he was being a good company man to be like, look, let's have Disney make this. We want to give you, Disney, our best work and make this a Disney film that you will own. And they're just like, fuck it.
Yeah.
We don't care.
Didn't even watch it.
Nope.
So let's talk about the first movie that they made, The Secret of Nim, and the production of it. Then we'll get into the movie. So The Secret of Nim, of course, is based on a Newbery Award-winning 1971 children's book called Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim. Apparently, that was sort of a staple of school reading assignments of the 70s and perhaps the early 80s, early to mid 80s.
Yeah, I did not read it at school. It was out of the rotation by the late 80s when I would have started getting assigned Newbery Award books. So, yeah, I've always wondered what the original Frisbee is like. All I know is reading synopses of what they changed for this movie.
I kind of want to read it now. It's only 200 pages and it is a kid's book, but I have not done that yet.
That'll just fly right by, yeah.
The history of this possibly being an animated feature goes back to Disney. So one of the many nine old men, there's nine of them, Ken Anderson, he got a hold of the book and gave it to Bluth because he's like, this story is amazing. You should make this into a movie. You should pitch this to Ron Miller or whoever you need to pitch this to make it a movie. So after finishing his duties on Pete's Dragon, Bluth pitched the idea to Wooly Reitherman, another one of the nine old men, who shot the idea down. We're talking about a lot of old men here.
Man.
And he said, okay, Disney's got Mickey. We just made The Rescuers. There's enough mice.
I would say after The Rescuers, it's time that I would also be in the mood of like, can we change these to like cats or dogs?
Let's pivot from mice.
It's but a lot of mice.
Basically, everybody who would eventually leave to form Bluth Productions loved the idea of making Nim into a children's movie. So a former Disney executive had then just founded Aurora Productions, and he knew about Ken Anderson's love of Nim and got in touch with Gary Goldman. This executive knew that Gary, Don, and John were, you know, leaving Disney, very talented, and he wanted to know, like, I want to make an animated movie with you. I have this new studio. By the way, don't look at anything Aurora Productions made. Secret of Nim is the best thing they made. They made, like, seven movies, and they closed in 1990.
Okay.
But he basically called Gary and was like, will you guys make a movie for us? And Gary had no other pitches but The Secret of Nim, and the guy from Aurora Productions secured the rights to that book.
Nice. Yeah. Wow. I think it's interesting. I didn't realize that it took another ex-Disney person to make it. That's why this all feels like what Disney could have had. It's just an extant of Disney making the decisions Disney ended up not making, even though they should have, kind of thing. I also think Gary Goldman, he is such a key player to this. Like, I think he is the second in command that helped. Like, Don Bluth couldn't have gotten any of this stuff done if he didn't have Goldman as a producing partner to take the calls he's also an animator as well.
Yeah. He's a highly skilled animator. I think the last thing he animated was a scene of like the dinosaurs getting stuck in the tar in The Land Before Time. But after that, he was too busy being a producer. And you know what? Animation kills you. Actually, it kills you, but it also makes you live forever.
Yeah, if you call that living.
You need a flat ass to be an animator, though. So they would have $5.7 million and 30 months to complete the film, which in that era was a much smaller budget and a much smaller time period than they were used to working on with Disney movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in the movie you can really tell the budget crunch at some parts there. It's an independent or not independent exactly, but it's a different production than Disney has. Like, they just don't have the money that Disney has, and it's the kind of risk you got to take on your first feature as well.
Yeah, essentially they were trying to make a Disney style studio from scratch. Basically, Disney was relying on all of the nine old men, the ones that were remaining, for this knowledge. And thankfully, they did not burn bridges with all of them, although I believe Frank and Ollie were pissed about them leaving.
I see. They were pissed at Bluth and company.
Yeah, because it's like, you hurt Disney. Like, this hurt our company that we're working at for life.
Well, and two, in the kind of mentorship program, it's hard not to, I could see them feeling betrayed by like, we took you under our wings. We were going to elevate you to be the next generation and you betrayed us and left after we gave you all these, this information and skills and all this stuff.
And I'm sure it was a very like patriarchal hierarchy because these are all men like born in 1905. They're like, why would these young men disobey us? We're their animation deities.
My father beat me in the woodshed. You're like, now I got to be nice to this kid.
I think they're like older than the Greatest Generation.
Yes, yeah.
By like a decade.
They were like, we were too old to be drafted.
I can't go to wars.
They had 100 in-house employees, an additional 45 people working from home painting cells. So amazing. It was a very large-scale operation.
Yeah, that's amazing. So many drawings to do and to do it independently, like just to keep structurally, to keep track of all those things and also just the physical production of those cells and to keep track of them and to photograph them and have them all on hand. Like, that's insane to do as your first real job.
I think one of the first things that happened at Don Bluth Studios was they spent like 6 months building this like massive multi-plane camera because Disney was not doing multi-plane animation anymore for the most part. And if you want to know what that's like, think of like parallax scrolling in video games where there's like different layers moving at different rates. It's like, it's a very expensive process when you're moving around sheets of celluloid and paintings and things like that. Like it's very expensive to do with multiple layers. That's why Disney wasn't doing it anymore.
Animation is hard enough to do with just one cell on one background. If you have like five or six layers moving around to show off like the forest in Bambi, it looks incredible, but most people don't understand the amount of work done to just make it look that good.
And if you look at this movie with just an eye for craftsmanship, you can see just all the multi-level shots they're doing. You can also see they're really playing with lighting a lot. They love playing with lighting. They have the ability to light the cells from underneath using different gels. So when you see something that's lit up, it's a picture of some like light coming up through the cell with like a gel over it. Like especially with that damn spinning orb or whatever later in the movie that just spins for 30 seconds and just like colors everybody.
There's a lot of opulent flourishes in this. Like the Akira comparison is very correct. Because they're showing off with like strings or movement or like doubling up things or like something moves in a mirror from a different angle. And I just think like you could have made this easier, but I love that you put in the extra work to show off like we're the best animators in the world because we drew all this shit. You couldn't draw this.
It's so self-indulgent, but I like it. It's like, this scene didn't need a mirror in it. This scene of characters talking, they didn't need to be introduced by being reflected in bubbles for 30 seconds. Yeah. It's crazy.
We didn't need five different scenes where strings are tangled up and undone and we keep track of every piece of string.
So the film, unexpectedly, the film went over budget to the point where the animators were working like 100-hour weeks. Bluth, Pomeroy, and Goldman, and I believe some Aurora executives, had to mortgage their houses to secure basically close to $1 million to finish the movie.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That is a real risk on this film, which is the first of its kind, an independent... Like there hadn't been a movie like this in American history, maybe, of animation.
And it was also the first animated movie where profit sharing also went down to the lower level people. And by that I meant the artists, which are the people that are making the movie happen. Yeah. So not just executives.
Those peons who actually drew it? That's shocking.
I mean, unfortunately, the movie didn't make a lot of money, but that idea was on the table for them. Like, you will profit from this movie if it does well.
You know, I wondered at times with other things that have profit share... The reason they didn't get as big as they could have is because of an active attempt to limit its success by people who didn't want to share profits like that. I think of how Marvel owns the rights to this comic company called Malibu, which was kind of a flash in the pan hit in the mid-90s with like these comics like called Prime and all this and Mantra. They weren't big hits, but they were hits. Marvel bought them, and at first they were going to publish them. Now they won't even reprint their comics because they have partial ownership every creator has partial ownership over the characters. So Marvel's like, well, we own them so no one else can publish it, but we don't want to publish it because other people will make money.
I'm not cutting a check for $30. I'm the Disney Corporation, damn it. The story for Nim was adapted by Bluth, Pomeroy, and Goldman, along with an animator called Will Finn. And you could tell it is a very artist-driven story, and that story really just comes second. I feel like there are so many scenes in this where someone had an idea for like a set piece or a concept that would look good in animation, and they found a way to fit it in, which is why I think Jeremy exists in this story. We'll get to Jeremy. I don't like Jeremy. Okay. But I didn't read the book for this. I didn't go a lot into the book in terms of research. Maybe in the comments you can let us know how the book differs from the movie. One of the major elements in the movie, though, is the idea of magic is in the movie, because Bluth believes it's very cute and I think very innocent that Bluth believes that animation is magic. Aww. So animated movies should have a magical element in them.
I mean, that's what our friends on OKKO, their whole ethos, like the end theme song to OKKO is it's only magic because animation is a magic trick.
It really is, yeah.
That is a very cute and sweet thing. The literal-minded jerk in my brain says there's too much magic in this that is completely unexplained, and when you already have magic science rats, they don't need to also be sorcerers.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of it's a hat on a hat.
The magic is a metaphor, but it's also real, which annoys me. But we'll get into that later. By the way, we like the movie, but it's fun to take apart the logic of The Secret of Nim, the movie version.
But these are also people who, like, they're not trained screenwriters. And they're used to adapting things, and this time they're kind of doing it without a net. I like how artist-driven it is in some ways, but I do kind of wish they had a story-focused producing partner that could help them lay out these beats a little better. I think that maybe is what they had for, say, Land Before Time and American Tale.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
In both cases, they had, like, Spielberg, Lucas, these more story-focused guys who can just say, like, you know, shouldn't this happen then? Or what's the emotional feel we're supposed to have here? There's especially there's a couple of plot lines that just get dropped and then picked up at the very end. Like, oh no, we didn't forget that plot line. Like, I think that comes from really caring about what you draw first, not what story is told ultimately.
It's really more about the craft than the characters. But let's talk about the release of the movie. So it came out in July of 82, and it got a very bad start with a rollout campaign. So it didn't open in theaters everywhere at the same time. It started on the West Coast with 127 theaters and eventually would reach 670 theaters by the time it hit the East Coast in about 2 to 3 weeks. But number one, need to point this out, everybody. This was the summer of a little guy named E.T.
Oh, boy.
Get out of the way. He will murder your movie with that magic finger.
You've got nothing on E.T. No, what child? I could imagine that children of 1982 would rather see E.T. for a fifth time than some rap movie that doesn't have ads for it anywhere.
100%, yeah. And Gary Goldman swears, like, if they had released this movie in August, we would have done much better, because I believe E.T. was, like, May or maybe late April of 82, just remembering offhand. And that would have allowed the E.T. hype to die down a little.
Yeah.
Or at least everyone would have seen E.T. and were ready for something new.
They'd had a little more space away from E.T. It feels like, it was United Artists, wasn't it? Like, they just kind of, it feels like they kind of dumped it. But also, I think it was like Warner. This came up on the Mask of the Phantasm one, that it always goes back to Disney and how everything is done in the shadow of Disney. But they said about it, like, money-wise, Mask of the Phantasm didn't make what it makes. And their feeling was, only Disney really knows how to market this in America and make people come to a theater and see a movie. And for an animated feature, if you're not Disney, back then, it seemed like nobody knew how to market it or how to get kids into the theaters back then.
Yeah, they really had the marketing muscle to make almost every movie work, except for, The Black Cauldron.
Black Cauldron, that's kind of the bottom of it.
Sort of Nim kicking Disney in the ass into making something darker, right?
Yeah, yeah. I feel like Black Cauldron comes comes off as a response of like, oh, well, they took Nim. We should have had the Book of Nim, and we should have made this darker thing. So we're going to adapt a different dark fantasy kids novel, but we're going to get even darker. And that's a story for another day. But they regretted that choice to make it dark by the time the film was done.
And Don Bluth Studios had definitely their ups and downs. So it was sort of like up, down for them.
Yeah.
Where this movie fails. I forget when their bankruptcy happens, but they go from making their dream project to doing Dragon's Lair and Space Ace, which I'm sure they had fun with, but it's not what they wanted to do. Like,
no.
Making these sort of disconnected, like, fun set pieces that weren't really a real story without any real characters. They were just, like, archetypes in a video game setting. And eventually, they would be purchased by another company and move to Ireland for the Irish tax shelter thing.
Oh, wow. I didn't know the Ireland part. Wow.
Yes. And that's when they would make things like An American Tale, Land Before Time, etc. This is just like a really brief history. Again, we can't do the whole history. We don't have enough time. But 90s was like a real suck fest for Don Bluth, where Anastasia was like the peak. But it cost so much money that I think it didn't actually make a profit. I remember... there was like a Q&A with Don Bluth on this animation website, like in the late 90s or early 2000s. And it was sort of him soliciting questions. Maybe it was his website. I forget the context. But he was like, ask me anything you want. By the way, if you worked on Anastasia, I can't pay you. You're not the person. I'm not the person you need to talk to. You need to talk to Fox or whatever. He basically was like, not even joking, just like, I can't pay you for that movie.
Wow.
So I think people were getting ripped off, or there's some sort of behind the scenes just grossness there.
Yeah, but that doesn't sound good. Yeah. That's extra sad. Well, I think Fox was a bad partner for them too. I mean, everybody. The 90s were full of, you can't have the successes of the Disney Renaissance without every other studio deciding they need to have that too. It's like with the Marvel movies now, every other studio that isn't Disney feels like they have to have their tentpole cinematic universe, and they all fuck it up because in some way or another. And Fox was another of those. Like, Warner decided they wanted to have their own feature animation, and after Quest for Camelot and Iron Giant, they're like, nah. And same, Fox had, they got into business with Bluth, which was a smart idea, but Fox didn't know what to do with it. And then they weren't sure how they wanted, like, how kiddie do we want this to be or not? And that, I think that led to the end where they thought, okay, can we just make an adult animated thing with Titan A.E.? And it just came at the wrong time, too. And
yeah.
And Titan A.E. as well was them trying to get CGI around Don Bluth animation. And it just, the bridge didn't work. Like, it's not his bag, baby.
And after that, he was like, you know what? I'm done with animation. I've tried as hard as I can. I'm just going to do children's theater in Scottsdale, Arizona. And that's what he does, which is really cool. Fosters the arts. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that was amazing to see on the Kickstarter thing that's what he does now. That, like, Gary Goldman, I think the Kickstarter video for Dragon's Lair, which that Kickstarter did not go.
No.
But it was Goldman going to Bluth saying, like, would you do this? He's like, well, I'm doing a Wizard of Oz show right now. I'm directing this. Like, but do that into your while away your final years doing that. Like, it sounds relaxing and fun. Way better than working with a Hollywood executive to try to make another fucking cartoon that'll be shit out.
Slaving over an animation table at 84, however old he is.
Just hug your children or whatever. Yeah. Your grandkids, your great grandkids even.